Welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We are teaching the world to use some rhetoric to rebuild the world or improve the world. I don't know. Clean up the world somehow. Complicated times require sophisticated techniques, it seems. So let's try to do some of that. I'm Dr. Dan, rhetoric PhD and escaped professor, stand-up late-night comedy writer from Hollywood, founder of Rhetoric Warriors. The podcast does three things. I talk to comedians about their politics and their careers, which is fun. I actively convert conservatives on here because they worry me. I think they can use some rearranging. And I talk to people who are actively out there persuading. Persuasion pros, social issue combatants, politicians, and of course, rhetoricians. More rhetoricians on this podcast than any other. So this week, my guest is somebody I really don't know at all, which is unusual. Usually I know the people I'm talking to, but she's, we kind of found each other, and she's a person who does something that I kind of find very interesting, where you're doing a lot of social issue work in the world, but you're also doing it inside of a corporation. I think you do diversity training and human resources. And so we're going to talk about that today, and she's going to give us some perspectives. Welcome, Denise Rogers.
Thanks. Nice to meet you officially, finally.
Yeah, show everybody your ducks. We've been trying. Show everybody your ducks.
Yeah, it's kind of bad product placement, I guess, or maybe it's really smart product placement, but.
It's got, yeah, you know, that's a billboard. That's,
yeah.
That's cool. So who made your ducks? Tell us about the ducks.
So the ducks, they represent, I don't know if you can see the entire shirt. Let me see if I can kind of lift up. So this is Taylor Pride. I live right outside of Austin, Texas, in a town called Taylor. We're sort of northeast, just right outside of Hutto, and pretty small conservative town, or at least was once a conservative town. It's come a long, long way, especially now as people are moving from Austin. And
yeah, I was going to say Austin's tentacles, its liberal tentacles are reaching out like a little
definitely
octopus.
Definitely. You know, first it was the artists and the musicians who started to come out and look for inexpensive buildings and stuff, studio space. And then, you know, the families are starting to follow, and progressive families are coming out this way, and things are really changing for the better. Absolutely for the better. So during pandemic, I was telling you, during pandemic, when we were all feeling really isolated, I was kind of worried about our LGBTQ community out here, who's even more isolated and marginalized in this area, and or in rural areas in general. And I started just a little private community page so they could find each other and we could hang on to each other. And I really thought we'd get a couple dozen people. We of course invited allies as well. And within 2 weeks, we had several hundred people join the group, and many who had lived in the area for, you know, a decade or more, who'd said, you know, I've never met another gay couple like ever. I've never met another trans person. You know what I mean? Like, I just didn't realize how isolated and how marginalized they were. And they were very excited to find each other. And so immediately really wanted to celebrate each other as well. And so we did our first Pride event that year, virtual, and it was really well attended. We had several thousand people join that event, which was really exciting.
Wow. Yeah, that's big.
We had no idea. We sold several hundred signs. People displayed all year long, not just during Pride month. So if you drive around Taylor, you'll see these rainbow ducks everywhere. People were finally not afraid to say, you know, I'm part of the community, or I'm an ally.
I'm a rainbow duck.
Rainbow duck. Yeah, I'm a rainbow duck. So exciting. So it's been good stuff. We will be hosting our very first in-person event this June. And we welcome everyone. We have people coming from all over Texas, actually. We've had a lot of RSVPs from all over Texas, which is very exciting. Turns out there aren't a lot of Pride events happening in June this year. So,
yeah. So do me a favor and run your background a little bit, because like I said, I don't know you at all. So just sort of orient in the world to who is Denise Rogers. And by the way, there's a Diana Rogers in paleo who I've known forever, so that name keeps intruding on your name. I literally wrote Diana the first few times, and I was like, no, that's not right.
Well, it's okay. I usually get like a Denise Richards or, you know, something like that. I'm like, I'm not quite that famous, but yeah, that's okay. I'll forgive you.
Just letting you know.
It's all right. Already forgiven. So I don't know, you know, I'm a mom first and foremost. We are an LGBTQ family. I represent the B. I'm a bisexual woman. I have a lesbian daughter and a transgender daughter and a son who is a very active ally. In our personal life, I'm an activist. And then in my professional life, I hold a couple of different roles, a couple of different hats, but I am a regional, what we call a PDI or diversity and inclusion leader. And then for our national Pride employee resource group, I co-chair that group as well. So I spend a lot of time talking about, you know, diversity and inclusion. It's what I love. Yep.
So where are you originally from?
All over Texas. I grew up mostly in Corpus Christi though. And that's probably where my activism really started, in the gay community in the 90s, advocating for HIV education and, you know, tired of bearing friends, even as, you know, late teen, early 20s. And I just kind of went from there. It's never stopped.
And you've been able to work this into your actual career? Like, I know, like, I see this mm-hmm. a lot with people that have a really strong social issue orientation to something, whatever it is in their personal life. And they do a lot of work, like you're talking about before we jumped on, about how much of your life it takes up to do social mm-hmm. activism, but actually moving that over into part of your job, like talk about that a little bit. Like how were you able to do that?
Well, as you get to know me, you'll learn that I'm definitely a person who, if something doesn't exist and I want it, I make it happen. I create it. I had a kind of standard Monday through Friday grind, set in a cubicle job for an amazing company. I work for a really fantastic company. But it was a large company, and in the Texas region, that whole D&I really hadn't filtered down, you know? And I knew it was out there, but it just hadn't gotten to us. And once I really figured out that it was out there, I wasn't okay with it not being here to us. And so just sort of putting in the work and trying to balance it and my day job. And then our company split, and the focus of the new company is heavily based in inclusion and, you know, just creating those safe spaces for everyone to be their authentic selves. And so all that work I was doing on the side now actually became a thing. A real focus, actual like tangible accountability and numbers and things behind it. And I was already in it. So they were like, how about you just keep doing what you're doing and we'll give you a title, you know? And so that's how it worked out for me. I lucked out. Yeah.
So is that like a half the job or is that your full-time job there now?
It is now. Now it's what I do.
Mm-hmm. And you said a lot of that job feels like, I mean, one of the interesting things, so my background, again, PhD in rhetoric, basically rhetoric tries to look at whatever persuasion situation you might be in and apply sort of formal theory and techniques to that to make you more effective, right? And so there's this 2,500 year history of the study of persuasion that almost nobody ever knows. So you get people like you who are actively persuading, actively, you know, on an issue and doing these things. But you're doing it typically, you know, you get some training along the way and whatever education you get with a little bit of persuasion here and there, but you're doing it without the formal kind of tools, mm-hmm. you know, the weaponry, as I kind of call it. And so when I see somebody out there like you who's been living this for a long time, I'm really curious about the experience of going into these communities and trying to get change or trying to get agreement. Because one of the things I do with rhetoric is I sort of break down a persuadability profile. Like, here's your yes, yes people. They're the ones that are pretty easy. You know, they agree with you and there's not a lot of disagreement. And over here, your no, no's. Mm-hmm. There's just nothing, hardly anything there. And then in between, you have yes, no's and no, yeses. And that's where you do most of your work. is people that have some positivity towards this, but still some lingering negativity, or a lot of negativity, but some positivity. Right. So I'm curious, like when you go in, how much of your work, because it sounds like in Taylor, like you said, it's a conservative community, but there's pockets of people who are yes, yeses, who are supporters. Mm-hmm. So like when you do that kind of work out in the world, activism, like in Texas, and you're close enough to Austin to have that mothership of goodness versus the corporate work. Like, talk about the difference in that. Like,
sure. Well, I think we all have a special power. You know, you have to kind of know your power. And I think part of mine is that I'm really good at being a chameleon, but two, I understand that my privilege is that I don't look threatening. I don't maybe necessarily fit the stereotype of some of those scary groups.
But you are. Is that what you're going
to
say?
Right. I totally am on the inside, right? But on the outside, if you were to look at me, you wouldn't think that. And so it's very easy to welcome me into your home, into your circle, into your meeting, into your whatever, and build that trust and that relationship, and then feel safe enough to listen to what I have to say. And I think I learned that at a very young age, that I have the ability to bridge that gap between what people fear and, you know, and
that's great. Yeah. That's a good rhetoric tool.
That's a survival skill of mine. But then also too, I've also learned just with trial and error that people want to know what's in it for them. And so for instance, you know, I work in a pretty homogenized industry, and, you know, I spend the majority of my time talking to that 80% of leadership who are Caucasian, heterosexual, cisgendered male, and, you know, really getting them to understand
those people.
No, we love those people. And there's a place for everyone, right? But helping them understand the benefits of diversity and inclusion, what's in it for them and what they can contribute. That's the other thing. A lot of them think that they just don't have a place, and helping them understand that the importance of allyship. So yeah, you know, buy-in, what's in it for you?
Tell me what's in it for the leadership white guys?
Well, and you know, in our industry, I mean, in business in general, it's most of the time it's bottom line. I mean, when you have diverse employees and thought processes, I mean, you reach solutions faster, you can reach a broader market, you have obviously much more thought and innovation, and that always trickles down to the bottom line. So there's that. you know, and sometimes it's personal. You don't know what you don't know. And if you've always lived in a box and you've always surrounded yourself with the same people that look just like you and think just like you, you don't even know what you're capable of or what you might find interesting, or, you know, and so it's just offering the opportunity to come in and learn something new, not forcing it, but offering it up. And then usually when they do, they come in and they realize it was something really enjoyable, or, you know, something they find really interesting. And yeah. So, and then again, oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Keep going. I was just going to say, and also too, it's just that pride of being in our industry and being the leaders in this, in our industry.
Yeah.
And then having that pride of like people looking to us, and that's, you know, that's a big one too. Ego and pride are good drivers.
For sure. I think, again, like I said, most people are kind of intuitive or informal persuaders. And especially if you've been in situations like you've been in for a long time, where, you know, you need to affect change on particular populations, and each population is different, you create a lot of tools and a lot of approaches and things, because that's what humans do. We try to figure out how to be effective in those situations. So tell me some stories, like where you've been, like early versus later, or places you've gone into or people you've talked to that were difficult, that took more effort to get to.
Goodness. Well, you know, yesterday actually was probably a perfect example. Here in our town, we have, you know, your evil community Facebook pages that everyone in the community is a part of. And of course you have that handful of trolls. Most of our trolls tend to be very outspoken, I don't think they represent the majority, but very outspoken religious fanatics. We have about 10 of them. And so yesterday I made a post about selling the yard signs I was telling you about. And of course the trolls, you know, immediately attacked with the scripture and all the things that they do. And really just, it was in the past, I used to be very emotional. I used to react very emotionally and very defensively. And I've definitely learned that that just feeds the troll.
Right.
And no one hears anything, right? We're just all defensive. So just really using that opportunity to educate them, to get down to their level and stay positive and invite them, you know, and that sort of thing. And it's interesting how quickly that blockage fizzles out. You know what I mean? That the opposition fizzles out. And it got to the point where one of them was even sharing our post and our information. And, you know, because he took the time to ask the questions and he was obviously looking for a very defensive response. And instead he got education and he got open arms and it was a conversion. So that was a good one, but it definitely took some on my part. I have a lot more those positive moments, not being defensive, learning to not react emotional. And that's something it took me a minute to learn for sure.
Yeah, I mean, the psychology of actually going out and doing real persuasion mm-hmm. in the world is hard. Mm-hmm. Like you have to have sort of a zenness. I used to be married to a psychotherapist mm-hmm. and they get trained specific techniques to how to not take on other people's emotions mm-hmm. and how to not empathize because they're seeing, you know, 6-8 people a day with trauma and you have to be able to turn that off. And so you can learn how to do that where you don't get triggered yourself mm-hmm. by people. And the trolls are a great example of just a digital community that's allowed people to have a little power by triggering people.
Yes.
And absolutely. So learning how to not be triggered is a real thing.
It is, you know, I am an extreme empath. I really do take on everything for everybody. And I think maybe that's even the mom in me, but I also do energy work as well. I'm a Reiki practitioner. And I had to learn to put up that shield to, you know, when I go out into the world to do the work, even like, just like when I have someone on my table, right, and I'm about to do the work, I have to protect myself. It's definitely a pep talk all the time too. You know, it's a lot of pep talking.
But. Yeah, learning how to manage that, it's like I said, it's a real thing. So I have a policy generally on social media. Like I don't allow any, I'm a complete no negative zone. Like I don't mm-hmm. allow comments and that kind of stuff because I'm too sensitive to it. I know if I did a lot of it, you know, and I was doing specific conversion, then I would learn to deal with it, but I don't really want to. I don't want to be where I'm censoring myself and worried about the response. So I typically, I get any negativity, whatever, I just block it and just move it out. Because I think the social world is really powerful when it's a positive force coming at you, mm-hmm. even if it's not capturing the full range of humanity out there, I don't care. I just want the positive because I'm trying to do something specific. And so the support is really useful. But the trolling and the attacks, I'm like, I used to tell people, because I did stand up for, I've done stand up for 35 years. And I'm like, when somebody takes a shot at me or gives me a little heckle or wants to play troll, I'm like, you don't want to play this game with me.
Well, and that's the thing, you know, I can make you cry. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not afraid to make you cry. And the thing that I've learned to kind of control myself is it used to be about me and that troll or me and that heckler and how I'm going to make them feel because how they made me feel. And it became this battle. And what I realized was there's an audience. There's, even if it's just one person, one, you know what I mean? They're watching it and they're reading it or whatever, and it's affecting them as well. And so now my responses are always not about me or how their comment made me feel. It's the other person who's looking in. And I've stopped making it personal and definitely think about the larger group, or even if the larger group is only one other person, you know, it's bigger than me and bigger than that, me and that troll, you know? So that took a minute to learn, but it's my new guide for sure.
You've had a lot of minutes where you've learned.
Minutes. You know, I'll tell you what, this year has been a big growth year for me, but the last few years, definitely. I'm in my 40s now. I think that's what it is. I turned 40. I'm 43. So I'd say since being in my 40s, I've had a lot of learning growing up moments. finally, I kind of feel like a grown up now. But
3 kids and jobs and yeah, now you're in 40. Now you're grown up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get it. I never did, for example, like I never did politics. I never was particularly interested in politics. My background was essentially in entertainment. I worked on TV and film, and I taught screenwriting and television writing, and I've always been interested in story. And it wasn't until Trump sort of appeared on the landscape with he's what I call a rhetorical Viking. You know, he just came in with all these new weapons and just started causing trouble and hacking things apart. And the political landscape, people didn't know what to do. They don't know how to defend themselves from that kind of approach. And I'm like, you know, I think it may be time to actually haul up some of this training that I've gotten, try to help people with it a little bit. Mm-hmm. Cause you run into somebody like you who's been doing it actively. And like you said, you're still learning and you still feel, you know, I'm sure like all the lessons that you've learned, you try to bring forward to new moments. And so you've picked up a lot of skills. But most people, when they launch into these things, they have none of that background.
Sure.
I mean, zero. They have no emotional control. They have no cognitive understanding. They can't process the issue. And then you're coming in and trying to get change with those people. That's why I like the converting conservatives. I have a process for it that I teach in webinars where I'm like, you really shouldn't even try to persuade somebody until you have a relationship with them. Like at first it's just gathering information and letting them talk. Mm-hmm. And that creates a virtual or kind of a new relationship and they start to trust you. And then maybe you can do a little bit of persuasion, but just coming right in and like, I'm going to hammer this belief system into your head you're asking for trouble.
Absolutely. And you're right. I mean, it's been, I have over 2 decades of experience. Right. And so now it's being the voice for, or being the example for those people who are new to it, just not coming into it, especially this newer, younger generation, right? They're not coming in equipped with that experience, but they're definitely coming in with the conviction and the emotion and the agenda. And, you know, they know what they want to do, what they want to accomplish. So I feel a little bit like an elder now.
Yeah, I could see that.
You know,
that's a viable identity to hold in a community. They need elders.
It's, you know, I don't like the term, but yeah, it's, yeah, it doesn't make me feel good, but yes.
Well, like my daughter, I have a 18-year-old son and a 21-year-old daughter, and my daughter got into makeup very early. And so she got into the drag community and did makeup for a lot of the drag shows. And I took her once down to San Antonio for a traveling drag show, the national show that was down there at a big theater down there, and drove her down there with a friend of hers. And like, it started 3 hours late. We ended up getting home at like 3 a.m. But she was, you know, she's always been in that community and going in and rest and learning things and harvesting things and then bringing it out. And I'll talk to her about it a little bit. And I'm like, I know she's got the conviction. Sometimes I'm like, let me also try to help you with the cognitive architecture to be able to defend this or transfer it to somebody else instead of just getting incensed that somebody won't instantly accept all the changes that you want so that the drag queens feel, you know, more comfortable in the regular world.
Right. I mean, it takes time to learn how to be an ally, the right kind of ally for whoever it is representing. So even for your daughter to be an ally for the drag community, it takes time to learn how to be an ally, at least the type, you know, how to show up for them the way that they need you to. And so, you know, and in the beginning, we just get out there. We just want to fight, right? We want to defend, we want to protect. And I've been there.
Well, talk about that a little bit. When you talk about ally, how would you define that? Like, how would you tell somebody about being a good ally?
Well, I mean, again, I think it's showing up and it isn't always protecting. Sometimes it's protecting, you know, sometimes it's just being who they need you to be or being available to them, being a friend, supporting. I mean, there's just so many different ways. I think each maybe sort of affinity group needs allies to show up for them very differently. I don't know, you know, it's also not only just for like an entire group, but also for a very specific person. So just because, you know, maybe the transgender community might need for us to be very vocal and right now really, really vocal on fighting, you know, a very specific transgender friend may not, because they may not be out or as open or as comfortable or whatever. So it really comes down to asking questions and learning the individual needs of who it is you're being an ally for. But there's no better tool in a person's toolbox than an ally. So
it's a great term for it too. Like, it's not, I mean, again, rhetoricians love words, love it when you find a very effective word that people don't really know how to defend themselves from. Mm-hmm. Everybody's going to want to be an ally.
Sure.
You know, that's a super word.
Yeah.
Like, we were the allies in World War II.
Mm-hmm. But it's a spectrum. It's a spectrum for sure. You know, people are kind of, you definitely, I think you even mentioned earlier, you know, there's people who are just like, I'm an ally for this group. And then there's, I'm an ally for this group, but just, if you need me, come to me. I'll be an ally over here. Right. And then there's some who are like, well, I want to be an ally, but I don't know how. So I'm just going to, and then some people just think they can't be allies. I get that a lot, especially from that male Caucasian heterosexual cisgendered group. You know, they're just like, I don't fit any of these categories. And so I feel lost, or, you know, how do I be an ally? And it's like, you can, for women need you. People of color need you. The LGBT community needs you. Yeah. To go back to your people and to I'm just kidding. Spread the good word. Huh. No,
it's, I mean, it's a real thing. Like, I'll give you a little bit of my background. So I'm originally from Louisville, Kentucky, and the kind of working class redneck side of Louisville. Mm-hmm. Louisville split into the South End, the East End, and the West End. And traditionally the South End is the poor whites, and that's where I grew up. And so I came from, you know, as and Catholic background, and it wasn't hardcore. It wasn't racist, that kind of stuff, really, because there wasn't any racial mixing at all. Like, I didn't meet other black guys until I played football in high school. Like, and that was only because we had a coach who came in from Chicago who went down to the West End, which is where most of the black community was, and recruited great athletes to come play at our high school. And we immediately won the state championship because he found, like, I mean, found guys that played in the NFL. Like, there was a guy, biggest human I've ever seen, 6'9", 345 pounds in high school.
Wow.
And he played like 12 years in the NFL for the San Francisco 49ers, was like great player. So he brought these guys over, and that was the first time, you know, I didn't have any categories. Mm-hmm. So I didn't feel like I had any racism. I had race ignorance, mm-hmm. and community ignorance and cultural ignorance. And then when I moved to Austin in my early 20s to go to grad school, I was dating a girl, and a friend of mine met her and afterwards said, you never mentioned that she was Mexican. And I'm like, it never occurred to me. I don't even have that as a category. And then realized, like, my uncle had come to San Antonio to go when he was in the Navy and married a Mexican woman. And my cousins were all half Mexican. So it never even occurred to me it was a category. So it's interesting, like, coming from that background where race isn't really even on the, it's not even on the docket to think about. Mm-hmm. And then getting exposure, like in grad school, suddenly you've got all this international and all this, you know, infusion of other cultures. So I never had a negativity towards it. And I'm always curious as like why that turns, why people, when they get that sort of super exposure to other, I guess maybe because I like stimulation, I like learning, I like new things, but so many people don't seem to.
Well, I grew up very similar in South Texas, really almost identical to your story. And you just, I think we said it earlier, you don't know what you don't know. And I know once I left Texas and moved to another state and saw other, not only learned of other races, but like there's diversity in race as well. You know, like I thought Chinese food was encompassing it. It's all, that's all there was, right? Now, obviously I know like, you know, my, you know, obviously there's Chinese food, Japanese food, you know, but there's everything, but I didn't grow up in that world. There was a Chinese buffet in my town. Like that's what I thought was, you know, I lived in South Texas. I thought everyone was Mexican. And people of color, you know, the diversity was not there, period. And it fascinates me when you get out and you experience this, that there's something other than this little bubble you're living in. To me, that fascinates me. I don't know if that does that for everyone. I mean, I think it may scare some people, so when I talk to people and usually they're opposed to what I'm talking about, my very first question usually is, have you ever met a transgender? Right. Have you ever met, like, because if it's not part of your experience, then you don't even know what you don't know, you know?
Yeah. Well, and it's got to start with that. And that's why I said, like, when I teach people conversion, like, it doesn't matter where people start. I don't care how extreme you are or anything else. Like, mm-hmm. if you start with gather, where you get their life story and their background, even if you're gathering their hate or their anger or that mm-hmm. kind of stuff, it morphs very quickly into, oh, you were, you know, treated really badly at some point by somebody else and you're using this to work it out. Mm-hmm. But you don't know that until you gather from them, until you, you know, harvest some of that information. And like when I came to grad school at UT, so I had the race wasn't an issue for me, but I'm clearly male, I'm clearly masculine, and I had no experience with feminism. You know, I didn't have antagonistic relationships with females, but when I got to grad school and ran into feminism and feminists, mm-hmm. it was a crash. Because I wasn't used to being aware of my masculinity or my gender. And there was, in that sort of traditional cultures, you know, there's antagonism between the genders and they joke mm-hmm. back and forth and all. And that did not go over at all in grad school. I remember a woman pulled me aside after, I don't know, maybe my first month. And she's like, hey, yeah, you need to stop that. You need to stop joking at the feminists. They don't think it's funny. And I wasn't like clowning, but I was just being non-serious. And they're like, no, these people are very ardent and very serious about their gender issues. I'm like, I've never run into this before. So I had to learn quick.
Well, I think, but on both sides, I think there could be, I think we could all learn to relax just a little on both sides. You know, I've definitely stood beside groups that, you know, that I'm an ally for. And even them, I'm just, and it, I would never say calm down, right? Because I don't understand their experience. But at the same time, I'm like, you know, we may get a better response if, you know, like we may get more buy-in if, again, not my experience, so I can't, but.
Well, and the other thing, again, talking to my daughter and trying to explain to her as a linguist, as somebody who studies language and uses language for particular purposes and formal ways, like all the complexity within these interpenetrating communities and cultures and solutions and problems, it's just incredible. Like the language issues around gender pronouns mm-hmm. are incredibly difficult because languages don't grow up with artificial intrusions. Like languages don't naturally take on an artificial new word. It's done organically over often thousands of years. And mm-hmm. then that word becomes incredibly natural. And so she would give me instruction all the time on the correct way to talk about drag queens or the terms. And I'm like, it's too much. Can't keep up. And so the cognitive load in these kind of issues is pretty heavy for a lot of people.
It is. I mean, especially like even for me, who's in it, it's part of my day-to-day life. And I am constantly updating or educating myself, and I'm still lagging, right? I still lag behind because it's constantly changing. So I can only imagine a person who starts from ground zero, right? It's so much, it's overwhelming. But it's no different than saying, you know what, I'm going to take a Spanish class, right? I'm going to learn a new language. The desire has to be there. And then grace comes with that, right? Like, as long as you have that true desire to learn and to want to do it right, I guess. I mean, to do it correctly is, you're given grace, you know? I mean, you don't get kicked out of the Spanish. You don't get kicked out of the Spanish class when it, because of pronunciation and stuff. But like, it's a learning process for all of us, and even those in it. I mean, it's hard even for myself. Like, you know, even am I bi? Am I pan? I don't even know anymore. I don't even know what my label is anymore. I don't know what my flag is anymore. I don't know what group I'm supposed to, who hates me this month. I don't know. You know, like even being a part of it, it's hard to keep up with. And so I can only imagine.
Yeah, it's interesting when you look at the things that are championed in the world, like acceptance and intermixed of cultures and innovation and infusions. And like, when you look at what American culture is, you know, described as the melting pot. And sometimes I describe it as the melting pit. I'm like, it's just everything dumped in there. And there's so much. I lived in Los Angeles for 10 years, and coming from the South, on the edge of the South, at least, I used to tell people, I don't see how anybody could be racist in Los Angeles, because they would be exhausted. Mm. You don't even know what everybody is. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like, am I supposed to hate you? What are, you know, there's just no way to keep up with. There's 194 countries on the planet. Wow. And that's not sub-regions and ethnicities and religions and everything else. Mm-hmm. So when you really globalize, you know, and that becomes the type of a global person is a positive for a lot of people. But the reality of it, again, is the cognitive load and the emotional load and the time and effort, you know, to stay up with this. And then when you make a small mistake, getting, you know, you can be crushed for it. So you can see why it becomes a really difficult issue for people to try to actually live globally, that globalism. And maybe that explains partly the big turn towards the Trump and MAGA. It was like, I just want a simple world,
you know? Yeah, no, I get it. I absolutely get it. But I don't think anything worth having is, you know, done easily. And I think that it's worth having, you know. But also too, I think we have to create and make it easy. You pronouns, for instance, you mentioned pronouns and how hard that is. Well, the more that we just put our pronouns, everyone, even if you're, you know, cisgendered, if everyone just put their pronouns in their signature block, or that's how you introduce yourself, then it's not hard anymore. We've made it a common language. We've made it easy. Until it shifts. Yeah, exactly. But I don't know. I think sometimes we make things a little bit harder than they need to be. But.
Well, that's what I said. Like, languages naturally tear out the bad, difficult parts. They go for simple. The things that create languages, that's why you end up with two gender pronouns, you know, because it's simple. Mm-hmm. And languages don't like complexity. They always trend towards simplicity. And when you make artificial changes fast, it just, you're going to get weird outcomes, because that's not the way languages are built. We're not good enough at language to be able to do that stuff. I know the word like cis. How much of the world do you think actually knows what cis means?
Right. Probably not very many. But most people don't even realize that they are cisgendered. If they aren't transgender, then you're cisgender. They probably don't even realize that, or have ever even heard that word.
Yeah. I'm thinking of my grandmother sometimes, backwoods Indiana woman, and just any of this flying at her at any point in her life would have just been like, you know, just watching it in the distance and not having any way of processing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know. I think recently I had used the term AFAB or something like that, like assigned female at birth, AFAB, or AMOB, which is assigned male at birth, versus versus, you know, they were born a male, or they were born, you know, born a boy, whatever.
Assigned, and does that mean like assigned by the doctors or the parents, or
assigned on their birth certificate?
The, okay,
the doctor. Yep. Yep. And you know, we've been in the transgender language with our my parents, my daughter's grandparents, for 6, going on 7 years now. So, people in our lives, I've almost always used the same term of born a boy, or you know, something like that. And we've learned that that's pretty offensive. And so using the term AMOB, or assigned male at birth, was very new to them. And they were just like, I just learned the other, you know what I mean? Or I just, yeah, you know, like I just got it in my head to start using, and now it's already changing. You know, some people are just like, I can't keep up. And then others are just like, okay, teach me the new one this week. You know, like, what is it? Like, how do I, but yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot for some, especially the generational gap, right? For sure.
So when you go down into the PICO level, the little micro details of like language and all that, that's one of the agendas that you, I think people will attend to and say, okay, what's the language that works here versus the mega issues and sort of the macro issues. Where, you know, when you look at like the politics of gender and sexuality, I know now, like with Caitlyn Jenner coming out this week and talking about trans in sports, and she's going to run for governor. And when it goes up to that level, I think that's when you start to see the bigger, broader, uninformed culture start to see these things in the, mm-hmm, in the mass media. And I don't think they know what to do with it.
They don't. I mean, well, representation matters always, right? And so there's, in the case of Caitlyn Jenner, I mean, she has a tremendous responsibility to her community to represent them in an authentic and in a positive way, especially because that's a community who is never represented in a positive or authentic way. I mean, most people, if you think of, if you even bring up the word transgender, the images that they have from their, anything they've ever seen on TV or no, you know, it's just really horrid. And yeah, so, you know, I have emotions about, but as a grown-up, I understand that people have agendas, and I understand what her agenda is. I don't agree with it, but I understand she's running for office and she needs votes, and so she's going to pander to a very particular group that she, you know, I get that. You know, I watch the transgender youth who are being heavily attacked right now across the country, and they're seeing this and they're going, but you're one of us and you're a grown up and not, and you don't even support, like, you know what I mean? And so sure, what does that do psychologically? And so, yeah, it's a tough one. It's a tough one. I think she has a tremendous amount of responsibility with her platform, and she's not doing it justice.
Who are the trans celebrities other than her that have got some type of visibility, like, or characters even in pop culture?
Oh gosh. Well, there's so many.
Like, I mean, like general, like I would know, like general visibility versus, you know, mm-hmm, and I've been around, like I said, I've been in education long enough, and I've got family members that are in LGBT. I always get it wrong.
LGBTQ plus, or you can just keep going and be like QIA. Like there's a lot, it just keeps going. The acronym is pretty, it's getting pretty long. So I just say LGBTQ plus.
Okay.
And that's exactly.
I'm going to do that. Yeah. So I've got family members who have been through this. I got some personal experience with it, but it's not like that kind of encompassing part of your life that you've had. And so for people like just in the general culture, what else is there in pop culture to look at? That's, cause I remember like when Will and Grace popped into, you know, the consciousness, and Ellen mm-hmm popped into the consciousness and mm-hmm normalized, you know, sort of gay and lesbian somewhat. And so I remember going through that and watching the culture just kind of slowly go, from to whatever, it's fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, that's representation. So say Will and Grace, for instance, you know, it was really kind of the first time we saw sort of an out and loud and flamboyant gay man, but it was funny, right? So we could accept it because he made us laugh, right? But he was balanced by that friend who you couldn't really tell that was gay. He was very metro. He could be your straight friend, you know what I mean? Like, and so they kind of balanced it with that. You know, it's representation. Ellen initially, it wasn't accepted, right? It took a long time for her to come back.
Yeah, she got canceled. Her sitcom got canceled because of coming out.
Yeah, and even when she came back, the premise behind her show was really, it was very giving, right? She gave away a lot of things. What's in it for me, right? It's always what's in it for me. So people bought into that because they really, she's kind and she's giving and she's, she's not as this scary lesbian monster that we, you know, thought, she, you know, that sort of thing. And so, it's how we represent them on screen. But, you know, a few of the big ones right now that are pretty active is like, for instance, Laverne Cox. She star of many things, and actually, well, the one that kind of, I guess maybe probably really launched her was Orange is the New Black, but she recently did a Netflix documentary all about transgender representation. And I think it's called Disclosure. I'd have to look it up. I think it's called Disclosure. And then Elliot Page, right? Like that's probably the most recent one, and with such an already loved actress and now actor. And so that's a really big one. But there's so many, and so many we probably don't even realize. That's the other thing, you know, because for the longest they were out there acting but not openly as transgender, and people didn't even realize.
Right.
For sure.
Yeah. From a mass rhetorician perspective of somebody that has created mass entertainment products, you look at that stuff and you're like, sooner or later, somebody's going to figure out, like you said, an angle that makes it acceptable and interesting and fun to watch. Mm-hmm. I watched Transparent some with, what was that guy's name? Jeffrey.
I can't think of his name, but he did a great job.
Yeah.
But but that's one that has an actress like Tracy Lissette. I'm trying to think of what her last name is. But that is one, Trace Lissette is her name. And that is one I watched that series as well and would have never known that she was transgender. She was a transgender woman. And they weren't open about it in the beginning.
Right.
Same thing with like Angelica Ross when she did American Horror Story, 1983 or 1987 or whatever that series was at the time. Never would have known.
Yeah. And Caitlyn Jenner's the one though, right? I mean, she's been in the mainstream culture media for so long and has gone through this in front of everybody. Mm-hmm. And so she's bringing that sort of all that history of Bruce Jenner being a cultural superstar in sports, which, and then going through the, you know, the Kardashians and now what he's sort of sitting on his own and trying to do a political career. It's just fascinating to watch somebody go through that and carry those different identities forward versus the kind of the niche. These are still niche media products. Like we're talking about, like even Ellen Page, I think I know who she is, but I can't mentally pull up what she's been in. I kind of know what she looks like or he looks like.
Elliot Page. It's now Elliot Page and
And I watched a lot of the comedians struggle with the stand-ups like Dave Chappelle and these guys. Like trans is the one, and if you look at it historically in comedy, it kind of makes sense because for a long time, famous comedians, it's one of the things their go-tos is just to dress up like a woman to get laughs. Mm-hmm. I mean, all the way back to Milton Berle and people like that in vaudeville were dressing up like women because it was funny, you know? And so it's hard in that tradition, I think, for comedians to extricate their brains and be able to, you know, now seeing this in a different category.
Well, I'll give it to you even from a parent's perspective, And I think this is where we struggle. You know, when we learn of actors or actresses or just transgender people in general who we didn't know prior to transition, we only know them as who they are today. That's very easy to digest. It's very easy to accept, right? It's no different than meeting anyone else for the first time. Because when you knew them before, you have to almost, there's this death of this person that you knew, and then this rebirth, but this rebirth of an existing person, you don't get to see them from baby to growth, right? You just see this whole person all of a sudden. And we don't know how to process that yet, right? And I know as a mother, as a parent, that was probably one of the toughest things for me. Like, I thought, no problem. I've been an actor. I'm part of the community. I've been a part of this, you know, I've been advocating for this group my whole life. So to have a transgender child should have been not just just another
Nobody's
day.
Nobody's better set up than you. You
right. Would. Just another day. Yet I mourned the loss of my son for a couple years. And I still get pictures and things, memories will pop up. And I still get sad because it's like that person, that child has passed, is no longer with us. But I have this new amazing daughter. Do you know what I mean? That I would never give up for anything. So to know someone before transition and after is a lot to digest, even for a person who is completely set up for it. You know what I mean? So I can't imagine what it would be like. I understand and I give grace to those who isn't part of their world. And, you know, so when they see someone like Caitlyn Jenner, who was once Bruce their entire life, they, as a child, ate cereal with them in the morning, you know, on their cereal box, or they watched them on TV, or, you know, that sort of thing. Or they watched them for years with the Kardashians on TV as entertainment, or they, you know, and then all of a sudden it's a different situation. And then they also are pandering to those fears that you have and that lack of education and knowledge of that community and of what those, that experience, for whatever his agenda or her agenda is.
That's really an interesting way of thinking about it. Like, that's really useful, that the idea of it is a different person, you know, that you got to mourn it. You got to trend, you know, mm-hmm. You got to have a story to be able to interpret that with. That's mm-hmm. a really powerful way of looking at it.
And you almost lack the closure too. Like it's not like a real death, right? So you lack that closure. And we need that as humans. So it's an interesting process. I think there's a lot of work to still be done there. Maybe, you know, psychologically, I don't know. I think there's a lot of work that can still be done there. There's a lot of unknown in that arena for sure.
Again, like when this stuff starts to rush in and I came from the working class. So going into higher academics, and I was at UT Austin, and it's one of the top 5 or 10 programs in the world, and very elite. And most of the people coming there were coming from at least the middle class, higher middle class. And my culture was far more brutal than what they were used to. And I wasn't particularly brutal, but I know that world really well. And compared to their world, the civility and the gentility and all that stuff, I'm like, no, I go right for things, and I don't sugarcoat things particularly well. I learned some skills as I went, but I kind of crashed into their world a few times, and I would say something in a public meeting or one of the academic meetings, and they'd be like, you could just feel it. Like, I remember once I started my PhD program, and they were doing the orientation meeting for the new grad students, and the old grad students were there, and they were being very gentle about it, and very like, you know, we'll make sure that if you get behind, we got no, no, no. And I was finally like, cause I'd come from UT, which was a PhD program, which was very sink or swim, like a very cutthroat academic environment. So finally I was like, I don't know what's going on here. Like, this is grad school, right? I don't want you to slow it down for them. I don't want to be exposed to other people's inferior learning processes. And I'm like, afterwards, the guy who invited or talked me into coming down there, the professor, was like, I know what you're doing, but they're not ready for that kind of bare summary honesty of things. This is not where they're at yet. And I'm like, yeah, I could see that.
Well, just like the art of persuasion, you know, soft skills is a real art. And, you know, I'm like you, I did grow up in the South, but I'm very much a Scorpio. I don't really do emotion and feelings and that sort of thing. Like,
and what Scorpios do, I don't know.
I'm not real warm and fuzzy always. You know, I just kind of get to the point. I'm brutally honest. I don't like to waste a lot of time or energy, you know, let's just get to it. And, so it definitely took me a little while to learn that, that's not how everyone or really most people operate. You know, they're a little bit, they need the delivery to be a little bit softer and a little bit more warm and fuzzy, or maybe not as direct or quite as honest. And while I may or may not agree with it all the time, I've definitely learned that in order to get the response that I want, or in order to have them hear me or whatever, those soft skills really come into, you know, they're useful. So
they are.
Yeah.
I lived in North Carolina for a while, and that's the first time I lived in like the South. Mm-hmm. Kentucky's a border state and it's kind of more Midwest than Southern where I grew up, and Louisville is more Midwest. And so watching the Southerners and that Southern tradition of never saying what you mean and mm-hmm. doing everything backstage and front stage is all just kind of courtesy and friendliness. Yeah. I was like, oh, this is how you guys do it. Like, mm-hmm. this is not my world. This is too much subterfuge for me.
Yeah. It's that bless their heart, right? Like, they're being really mean, but it's so sweet, you know, like outwardly it's so sweet.
Yeah, but I kind of admire it. I admire, you know, when cultures grow up and have their ways of doing things. I like to poach. I like to learn, and having, like you said, soft skills. I was a professor for a long time, and you've got to kind of be soft skills when you're teaching people, you know, mm-hmm. because they just can't handle any kind of hammer at all. Mm-hmm. So
that's true. Learning to cater the message, right? The delivery to the receiver. That's a skill. I mean, that's talent for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of, again, rhetoric is working. That's what it is. Message work.
Mm-hmm.
It's totally, rhetoricians think about everything and do a ton of work on it before they say it, versus expressives. They're just like, I just want to say it. And I'm like, I get it. But when you're in high stakes and complicated environments, just saying it, unless you're particularly talented or like you, very experienced, you make too many mistakes. And those mm-hmm. mistakes end up killing your goals and what you're trying to accomplish. Mm-hmm. So
agreed.
Maybe work on it. Well, it's been super fun. You know so much about this. I really appreciate you talking to me about it.
Oh. Thanks. I don't know. I think I'm still a rookie, but I appreciate you listening.
Compared to most of the world, like, right?
Yeah.
You've done a ton. So anything you want people to go check out? Like, do you want to promote? You want to go promote the Taylor Pride thing?
Well, yeah, absolutely. TaylorPride.org. You know, it's new and up and coming, but it's doing some really great work. So we're really working towards creating a resource that doesn't exist in the role communities. So TaylorPride.org. And then right now, really, really important and big in my life is all of the anti-transgender, really all of the anti-LGBTQ bills that are happening across the nation, but very specifically the 100 plus that are targeting transgender community, specifically the youth. So I recommend going to equalitytexas.org as well, and being able to educate yourself on all the bills that are happening, keeping up with where they are and what you can do about them.
Oh my God, yeah. Even just like that, we didn't even really dig into the politics.
That's a whole nother podcast. That's a whole nother hour for sure. Sure. But it's a really big deal, and it's all happening right now. Very timely. I mean, there's a lot of things that are actually on the calendar and on the table today that could, you know, come to fruition or die by midnight tonight. So Equality Texas, it's really important that you go there.
Cool. Well,
Thanks.
Check that out. Go buy a Rainbow Duck shirt.
Yeah.
Or sign. I love that. Again, as an entertainment rhetorician, like anything that finds like a unique little twist on something, that's mm-hmm. great. I love the mm-hmm. Rainbow Ducks.
So we are the Taylor Ducks. That is our mascot. We're kind of, it's not a tough mascot. It's not, so we kind of get made fun of for it. So we try to, you know, to spotlight it as often as possible.
Yeah. There's a, I know in, God, where was it? There's somewhere called the Ganders. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm like, you can't have a high school nicknamed Ganders.
Like, well, our neighbor in town is the Hutto Hippos. So I don't know if I'd rather be a hippo or a duck, but.
Wow. Yeah, so there's times like the hippos play the ducks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
That's sounds great. Exciting, doesn't it?
It does. I'd actually maybe pretty go thrilling. To that game. Yeah. It'd be fun.
Yeah.
All right. Well, again, thanks very much. I appreciate it. This is Denise Rogers. Maybe we'll talk to you again about the politics of all this at some point, but
I would love that.
I need to say, so super fun.
So thanks for having me.
Yep. Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Get out there and persuade some people. They need it.